a rusting barbed wire fence, a spider spinning a web, then a converted barn beside a courtyard.
Do you remember when you were a kid, the day before your birthday, you couldn't sleep because you knew something special was coming? It's a little bit like that, crossed with the thought that maybe, you know, tomorrow there'll be a hurricane. You know, the weather's going to change and things are going to get really serious. Because you just know that life's going to change when the goshawk arrives.
A close-up view of a bird in a carry box.
10 years ago, my father died suddenly. Stricken with grief, I fled from humanity. I ran towards things of death and difficulty. Spooky, pale-eyed, feathered ghosts that lived and killed in woodland thickets.
She opens a car boot.
I ran towards goshawks.
With a falconry hood covering its eyes, a goshawk turns its head.
The story of how I trained my goshawk, Mabel, became a best-selling book. H is for hawk.
Helen opens the wooden carry box to find the goshawk.
Oh my God, she's amazing and so beautiful.
Hello.
But this fiery bird with light splashed feathers isn't Mabel. I'm training a new goshawk, and the prospect is terrifying. This is the raging, wild challenge of my future. A hawk that won't be a solution to grief, but my wings to somewhere new.
The hawk perches on her gloved hand with its mottled brown wings outstretched. H is for Hawk, the new chapter, with Helen MacDonald. The hawk lifts her broad, rounded wings above its body, revealing its delicate plumage. Helen's face lights up.
Wow. She's amazing. She's huge. She's like twice the size of Mabel. And is doing that goshawk magic thing already. She's transforming this room into something very unlike a domestic sphere. She's making it feel wild. It's like you've stepped into another world in here now. She's half dragon, half leopard. Something very old and prehistoric. She has this very light hood on, which just makes her think it's nighttime, so she's sort of sleepy as well. And I'm not going to challenge her today by taking that hood off. What I might do is sit with her and just talk to her and try and get across that this voice is not something to be feared. The journey begins, I guess. Here we go.
As night falls, speeded up footage of clouds drifting above the cottage. Now, a slow-motion replay of the hawk perched on Helen's gloved hand.
Training another hawk was inevitable, but I didn't know it. I didn't know that it would be the outcome of a journey that began earlier that year, when I set out to watch goshawks in the wild.
In a verdant forest, the sun peeks through the thick foliage.
To me, goshawks are among the most beautiful things the world has ever made. Their predatory grace is bewitching. They are big, bloody, deadly, scary, and very, very hard to see. Wild goshawks are magnificent phantoms. You might spend a week in a forest full of them and never see one. Just traces of their presence. A sudden hush, followed by the calls of terrified woodland birds, and a sense of something moving just beyond vision.
From an elevated viewpoint, a forested river valley.
I was desperate to see this most secretive of hawks in the wild. I knew they would be difficult to find. But then, everything about goshawks is difficult. Looking for goshawks is like looking for grace. It comes, but not often. And you don't get to say when or how.
A jet plane flies overhead, leaving contrails in its wake.
That spring, I could have counted on one hand the number of times I'd ever seen them in the wild. But I remembered one morning a decade ago, on a clear March day at the beginning of their breeding season, when suddenly, there they were. They had left their secret world under the trees to court each other, dancing in the open sky.
A lone hawk tucks its speckled wings into its body as it glides gracefully through the air. Now, with its wings flapping, the bird turns.
I remembered them so clearly because my memory of the hawk's graceful flight became caught up in a terrible moment.
In faded color, a car passes a two-story period home.
A few weeks later, my mum called me and told me that my father had died. Dad was one of the best photojournalists of his time. He took this photo of me. I still remember how itchy that sweater was, how still I had to sit. His unexpected death shattered all the stories I'd told myself about my life. Grief broke me. I didn't know who I was anymore. I found myself falling back into old ways of looking at the world. And my old childhood obsession started to return.
Home video of Helen as a teenage girl with a black crow perched on her hand.
For as long as I can remember, I've loved birds. I used to rear orphaned fledglings like my crow, Albert. But hawks were my favorite. When I was small, I loved them so much, I tried to sleep with my arms crossed at my back like wings. I even said prayers to the ancient Egyptian falcon god Horus.
I went on a falconry course when I was 13, and this is me with a Harris hawk, and I don't know, I looked joyous. I mean, I was. It was an amazing experience. And this is at the Bird of Prey Centre that I used to work at, and they taught me really how to handle birds. And then they gave me my first kestrel, and this is the one who used to sleep in my bedroom bookcase at night. My parents were unbelievably chilled out about this falconry business. I think twice my mother's told me, you know, are you sure you wouldn't rather be a lawyer than a falconer? It's really weird when you look at childhood pictures and you feel there's no continuity between you. This is sort of punctuated. This is one person, this is a different person. But in all the ones where I have hawks on my hands, you know, I remember those hawks, I remember those moments, and I feel like I'm the same person.
When Dad died, I started dreaming of hawks all the time. I wanted to fly with a hawk to salve my grief, cross from this world into another, wilder one.
One of the millions of reasons it was really hard to lose Dad wasn't just that he was a really good friend of mine, but we kind of saw the world in the same way. We were both watchers. I mean, it's a sort of spy shorthand, I guess. I got it from a John le Carré novel. You all copy your parents. It's kind of who you are. I guess what photography does is when you're in a scary situation, you can put the camera to your eye and you look through the viewfinder and it distances you from what you're seeing. You know, he said that was the way to be safe, is that you just look at it as a picture, you look through the lens. And I think with falconry, you know, when my dad died and my whole family was bereft, living with a hawk let me experience the world, in my imagination anyway, through her eyes. She was a little bit like a camera, a little bit like a viewfinder. And a hawk sees the world differently too. So it's a kind of an escape from your own vision, I think, in both cases, yeah.
Escape was all I wanted when he died of a heart attack. And this is what I escape to.
She smiles as she looks at an image of Mabel.
Mabel was my first goshawk. I trained a lot of birds of prey in my life. I never wanted to train a goshawk. I knew they were very highly strung, very hard to train. And then my dad died and I wanted a goshawk. When something bad happens, when you lose a loved one, you're often driven by, you know, almost unconscious motivations. I was driven to get this goshawk. The hawk had caught me. It was never the other way around.
Writing about Mabel was one of the ways I later tried to make sense of it all.
At an award ceremony.
And the winner of the 2014 Costa Book of the Year is H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald.
So I'm happy to announce that Helen MacDonald is the winner of the Samuel Johnson Prize in 2014 with H is for Hawk.
The book I wrote did really well. I didn't expect that. It's been quite exciting and a bit of a shock. The person that's in the book isn't really me anymore. I think what happens after a big bereavement is that you fall apart and you have to remake yourself as someone else, someone new, and that's who I am now, and that person in the book isn't really me anymore.
Helen's writing on a laptop. Now in slow motion, feathers falling against a black backdrop.
Just before I finished writing the book, Mabel died. A sudden, untreatable infection with aspergillosis, a deadly airborne fungal disease, carried her from her aviary to the dark woods where dwell the lost and the dead.
Airborne insects hover around sun-dappled foliage. Slender pine trees loom over the forest floor.
8 years on, I felt compelled to bring goshawks back into my life. So I turned to Rob, a friend of a friend, and my wild goshawk guru.
I like the fact that for most of the year, they're very secret birds, and you can't really see them.
Yeah.
And there's only one short window in the year that you can actually get close to them and observe
them. Right, which is when they're
breeding.
Breeding, yeah.
And the rest of the year, they just seem to disappear.
Yeah.
And for such a large bird, that's quite a trick.
No, it is. It's almost supernatural, isn't it? It's a ghostly way that they vanish.
I just think they're magical birds, really.
They are.
Years ago, Rob had taken me to see a nest right at the edge of England just before it tips into Wales. A land of wet forest and wild goshawks. And now I'd asked him to find me another.
They peer through binoculars.
One I could visit over the spring and summer to get a personal view of Britain's most elusive bird of prey.
Masked by the thick foliage of pine branches, they clock a large nest near the lower part of the canopy.
Wild goshawks are breeding again in Britain after over a century of extinction, and this forest is one of their strongholds.
Rising above the forest.
Their presence here reminds me that the wild does not have to be a thing untouched by human hearts and hands. The wild can be human work. Because in the 60s and 70s, British falconers worked out that for the cost of importing a European goshawk for falconry, you could bring in a second bird and release it. Buy one, set one free. Reintroduction isn't hard with a bird as self-reliant and predatory as a goshawk.
The bird swoops low to the ground.
After all, everything about these hawks is tuned to hunt and kill.
The hawk lowers its legs and lands on the forest floor, throwing up leaves. Now in a falconry hood.
Falconers brought goshawks back to life. And now I realized it was time to bring one back into mine. The strange thing was that the hawk I trained this summer would be, in one sense, immortal. For while individual goshawks die, their species has remained unchanged. They have no fancy varieties because they were always taken from the wild to be trained. The birds falconers fly today are identical to those of 5,000 years ago. Civilizations rise and fall, but the hawks stay the same. Today, British falconers only use aviary-bred birds, and goshawks are fiendishly difficult to breed.
From a close-up view of a hawk's eye to a bank of CCTV screens showing an aviary, while a kettle boils, a man watches the monitors, tapping his finger.
It's not for the faint-hearted. Even in the wild, there's a fine line between goshawk romance and terrible mortal violence. You can't just put a couple of goshawks in an aviary and leave them to it. More often than not, the female will kill her mate.
A long, dark hide.
Instead, you put them in separate, adjoining aviaries and monitor their behavior closely.
Three men are watching the CCTV screens.
Only when you think the female is ready, a piece of fine judgment that does not admit error, do you let the male into her chamber.
He's been a couple late, look here.
Yeah.
There we are. Come on, look. He's doing it right there. There you are. That's it. One copulation.
Hopefully she lays soon and it'll be fertile.
A clock passing time.
Wayne, Dave and Andy are goshawk breeders. During the mating season, they stare obsessively at screens showing live footage from their aviaries.
Helen stares intently at a screen while sipping a hot drink.
This is the best television ever. Forget American cop shows. I want to watch goshawks all day.
The goshawk on the monitor, Ellen, that's the mother to the goshawk you'll be having.
Look at her.
She's sat on eggs now.
Hello, you. When I got Mabel, I never saw the parents of the bird. And it's kind of lovely to see,
It must be great for you, having a bird and actually seeing the parents to the bird.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You know, it's got to be, give you a buzz for that anyway, to just see this.
Yes.
It's made me feel quite soppy,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of the things about goshawks that, you know, I sort of love, is that everyone thinks of them as being a bit like feathered shotguns, but actually they make people feel quite soppy as well.
Mm-hmm. There would be a goshawk for me to train. And I'd asked, if possible, for a female, like Mabel.
A carpet of bluebells sitting beneath tall trees.
A spring edged towards summer. The forest shone with new-spilled beauty. In the nest that Rob found for me, the chicks had hatched. Three small bundles of dense cotton wool waiting to be fed. A new goshawk family, descended from birds released by falconers, was being raised.
The goshawk perches on the edge of the nest, dropping meat into the beaks of the clamoring chicks.
Wild, spectacular, utterly at home, the presence of these British goshawks fills me with joy.
With a scrap of meat dangling from its beak, the goshawk takes flight. Now, a commanding aerial view of a river winding its way through lush grassland flanked by verdant forest.
For weeks, I waited anxiously, getting updates from Rob. And then, after almost a month, I went to see them for myself.
She's scaling a rope ladder, secured to a tree trunk. Now a smiling Helen uses some binoculars to look out at the nest from a hide.
I'm 50 foot up in the air, staring at a nest of baby goshawks, which is pretty extraordinary. They're at this really ludicrous stage where they look like moth-eaten eagles. And they can hear me, I think, because they're giving me evils through the foliage. It's amazing seeing them here. I never thought I'd see a goshawk nest at this level. I feel like kind of a bit of a spy.
Another hawk glides nimbly through the foliage and lands on the nest.
She's on the nest. Oh my gosh. Oh, she's spectacular. It's impossible to look at them without grinning. They're just so great.
One of the hawks is clutching a dead carcass in its beak.
There's a whole bunch of things these birds are doing which make my heart kind of ache a little because they're so familiar. And there's some great falconry terms. So when the young birds extend one wing to stretch and sort of drag it over their tail, it's called mantling. They do this thing too where they put both wings above their back. Really stretch them. And that's called warbling. It's really evocative of my time with Mabel. And yeah, it's great. A goshawk is a goshawk, I guess.
An infant takes some food from a hawk's beak.
One of the things my dad taught me, or tried to teach me when I was a kid, was this abstract thing called patience. And I was really bad at it when I was small. You know, he taught me that when you want to see something bad enough, you know, you just have to be really patient and wait. I never thought I'd see a family of wild goshawks like this in Britain, and here they are. You know, it's not just standing around waiting for long periods of time, it's just, you know, years passing and suddenly it's really emotional.
She smiles.
Patience. The word makes me think of one of my father's photographs. The sparrow is caught mid-hop. At the exact moment it picks a crumb from a street sweeper's fingers. The expression on his face is beautiful. To me, he looks like an angel. It took a lifetime's patience to capture that perfect moment.
The street sweeper looking gleeful.
It's strange to look at these little scraps of life up there and know that in an aviary, quite a long way from here, is a, you know, a chick that I'm going to get to know. And it'll be just as wild as these birds, you know. I'm going to become acquainted with one just like this pretty soon. It's very exciting.
One of the breeders is sitting at the kitchen table, watching the aviary's CCTV monitors.
For the breeders, the waiting and watching continues for about another 9 weeks after the chicks hatch. Only then will a parent-reared bird be ready to train.
As time passes, the breeder flits around the kitchen, but his eyes remain fixated on the grainy CCTV of the parent feeding the newborn chicks.
I still have more than 2 months to wait.
Now gliding over the lush green canopy of the forest.
On a thick, gloomy summer's evening, I returned to the nest. The forest was dim and vaulted green. It felt like an underwater cathedral. An old friend, Jimmy, was climbing to the nest. With a base jumper's adrenaline-wired demeanor, he looped the rope around the tree and began to climb as Rob and I watched. We had to work as quickly as possible.
Oh, it's quite tense watching them climb, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
They crane their heads skywards as Jimmy shimmies to the top of the tree. He takes the hawks from their nest and places them in a sack.
There aren't that many wild goshawks in Britain. Around 450 pairs. Fitting chicks with numbered rings helps track the population. And that's why Jimmy and Rob were here.
Precious cargo.
We'll get them all out together, Hannah.
Oh, she's huge.
Okay.
Yeah, there we go. And they're giving us the evils.
Two females and one male. Carefully assessed by Rob.
Using pliers, Rob attaches numbered rings.
Would it stress her out if I just gave quickly held her for a second?
No, that's fine.
Come on in, missus. She's a sweetie. Look at her. I just love that this point, just, you know, they haven't quite got their feathers yet. They've got these fuzzy heads like little snowmen and these wonderfully milky kind of bluey-grey eyes. They're really gorgeous, like little reptiles. I'm going to just smell it first because goshawks smell amazing. Hang on. Oh, nostalgia. That reminds me so much of Mabel. It's this weird smell. They should bottle it and put it in perfume bottles. But I think we should definitely get them back in the nest now. They've had their moment of contact with humanity, and it's time to return them, so... OK, so she's in safe.
Ringing gives us scientific data to help preserve birds like these. But there's more to this than science.
Off you go, little ones.
These chicks will probably never be held by human hands again. Might not even be seen again. But for a few moments, we had been allowed to touch the lives of creatures far wilder than ourselves. And I will never forget it.
Jimmy returns the hawks to their nest. Now, rising above the treetops of the dense woodland, then gliding along the forest floor among leaves and fern.
When I was small, the countryside was in crisis. Pesticides were wiping out hawks. Otters were gone. Dead elm trees were being burned. Rivers were dying. Everything was sick. And we'd be next. We lived in the shadow of nuclear war. I clung to hope as hard as I could, prayed that life would go on in spite of my fears. But then I grew up always expecting loss.
From pine cones on a branch to Helen's watercolour of a goshawk. Now black and white photos of Helen and her father. Then a sketch of a kestrel perched on a gloved hand.
I did this in July 1977, so I was 6 years old. And it's a male kestrel, and it's sitting on a glove. And you have this... I don't know, it makes my kind of heart go all weird. I'm really obsessed with its attachment to the glove. So the things that are tying it to the glove are really carefully drawn, and there's a dot on the glove that I've gone round and round with a pencil. It can't leave me. It has to stay here. I had a twin brother who died just after I was born, and I didn't know about this, and it was a real tragedy. And yet here I am, summoning something that could fly away. And making sure it can't, making sure it's with me. It's a really, really weird thing to look at now. And I think that's kind of what it's all about. Falconry's about things that can fly away, choosing to come back to you. It's all about returning, things returning that could go.
Helen's ambling through the forest among bracken and leaves.
On a dark summer's day, I returned to the forest. It would be 6 more weeks till the hawk-eyed train left her parents, but the wild chicks were older. The male had already left the nest, and soon his sisters would too.
Got a bit of a pang in my heart. This is probably the last time I'm going to see this particular year's family of goshawks before they go. It's really weird at this point when they've left the nest. There's a lovely falconry term for it, branches, which means they're kind of scrambling around, branches around the nest, and they're making little flights. They're not really cued into hunting yet. You know, they're much more interested in carrion and the things that the parents have brought. So she's kind of watching all the birds around with kind of interest, but she hasn't got that kind of predatory fire yet. But it's, you know, this whole wood is animated by that bird being there. It makes everything feel really quite exciting and special.
And these birds are going to start to slowly disperse and move away from this wood. They might come back visit, but this is kind of it. And it's the absolutely normal, slow dissolution of Goshawk family life for another year. I kind of want to salute her, you know. I wish her luck.
The bird buries its head beneath its wings.
It's a bit poignant for me.
Now Helen's at home, where she uses a metal ruler and a knife to score along a thin strip of brown leather. She dips the strip into a jar of water.
Jess's. A little scrap of social history in the name for a strip of leather. It's a French word from the 14th century, back when falconry was a favoured pastime of the ruling elite. These are the soft straps that fit through the leather anklets on a trained hawk's legs. It's a kind of ritual, making them.
She pulls the leather taut.
When I was waiting the night before I picked up Mabel in this hotel up in Scotland, I remember sitting down and making dresses like this, watching bad TV. I guess it really, really brought home to me that this isn't ever just about making falconry equipment. There's something about making jesses that was haunting, you know. And as I made them, the hawk became very real in my mind, and so did my dad. I remember him sort of almost like he was standing there in his grey shirt with his slightly wonky glasses and his tie and a cup of coffee. It was really, really a very strong moment.
Now Helen's by the kitchen window, gazing out at a small garden.
Everything's different now from all those years ago when I trained Mabel. I'm in a house that doesn't have a garden really suitable for keeping a goshawk in. And I'm a different person. I think I'm a lot softer these days. I guess I've kind of worked out that death waits for us all, and it's made me kind of love the world more and love people too more. And I don't really want that solitary withdrawal from the world to train a hawk. I want to kind of do it more sociably.
A barbed wire fence.
And so I went up to the Pennines to meet the hawk that I would train. This is where she'll live with Kirsty, her new owner, my friend and a fellow falconer.
She's going to be trained differently. She's going to be trained in that old school way. I'm getting used to people hanging out with Kirsty and her goshawk. Just making it a much, much less sort of miserable and lonely thing. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a really extraordinary experience, but very different one from before.
A spider's web, the hands of a clock, then a collection of tasseled falconry hoods.
I am, how can I put this without swearing? I'm pretty scared. I haven't really trained a hawk since Mabel, and that was, 10 years ago now.
Mabel was super chilled out from the word go. This bird could be a complete nightmare. So I don't know whether, the box will open and this kind of avenging angel will come out, desperate to sort of slay and stress me out beyond limits of human tolerance. We'll just, play it by ear, little by little. Patience, positive reinforcement, calmness, watchwords of training a hawk.
Helen's in awe as the hawk from the carry box is now perched on her gloved hand with its head bowed and checkered brown wings outstretched. Now, sun-dappled purple thistles waving in a gentle breeze.
People have trained hawks for thousands of years. A hawk must always be tamed from scratch. And the first step is gaining their trust.
In the living room, Helen removes the hawk's hood.
I want her to take food from my hand. But the strangeness of my presence scares her. She tries to get away, which is hard, because it's the opposite of everything I desire. I concentrate very hard on trying to be invisible, pretending not to be there, an ancient falconer's trick. This new hawk is bewildered. She stares and stares. Seconds slow and tick past.
Helen remains frozen, as the hawk looks around.
She's not happy with this unfamiliar situation. Her wings are dropped low. She is crouched, ready for flight. But she looks at the food beneath her feet.
In sharp, jerky movements, the hawk bobs her head, scanning the horizon.
It's been a long time since I've done this, but it's amazing. As soon as the world shrinks to just you and the bird, all those kind of old knowledges just come back like it was yesterday. I know it didn't look like it, but she was phenomenally calm. And there's a moment when you take the hood off a fresh bird where, this is going to sound very new age, but you kind of feel their spirit. And yeah, I'm in love. She's amazing. She's really, really steady. That was way more than I expected. I'm kind of a bit freaked out, actually.
It devours some meat.
I think, you know, crossing fingers, she's going to be a really cool hawk. That was amazing.
Helen writes the words, day one, in a diary.
Compared to Mabel, this bird is solid. Not just bigger, but she's kind of strong. She's got a really calm centre. She's immensely likeable and has already surprised the hell out of me.
In time-lapse, stars shoot across the night sky as hues of yellow and blue fill the horizon. Now in daylight, the shadow of a small bird is cast over a slanted tile roof. Helen's on the sofa with the hawk. The bird lowers its wings, then Helen gently removes its hood.
Everything this bird sees now is strange. She can see out the window there are ash tree leaves kind of being buffeted in the sunlight. There are swallows bombing around, there's shadows, there's kind of polarized light up there. Everything must be pretty mind-blowing, actually. So the fact that she's so calm and is treating this with such reasonable equanimity is a kind of miracle, really.
A close-up view of raindrops on a window, then Helen writes in her diary, mainly inside.
The secret to taming a hawk is to take things slowly.
A drowsy Helen rubs her eyes.
To move gradually from darkness into light.
Slithers of raw meat are lying beside the hawk's tether.
Go on, have a bite to eat. You'll feel better when you've had some dinner. I think I'm going to call her Lupin. It's one of those nice names. It sort of means the flower, but it also means wolf.
Helen makes her way out of the cottage.
There's a great tradition in falconry that you don't give birds of prey, particularly goshawks, scary names. So you don't call your goshawk, you know, Slayer or Vulcan or something like that. Because sort of superstition says that if you give a bird a name like that, it'll just sit on a fence post and squeak at you and do nothing. You give them cutesy names and then they become proficient hunters. So, yeah, I have a friend with a goshawk called Bunty. So I think Lupin kind of fits that. We'll just pretend it's the flower name so she'll become a proficient hunter.
Sitting on a bench by the cottage, she removes Lupin's hood and the hawk gapes at the view.
Everything fascinates her. Lupin can see with fierce clarity things I can't possibly resolve from the generalized blur. But this new world of Kirsty and her birds unnerves her too.
Step up. Good girl. Good girl.
And so we sit quietly at a distance, so she can see these things and not a threat.
Helen gazes at the inquisitive hawk. Now, a panorama of the cottage nestled in a valley flanked by grassy hills. Helen's inside, standing in a darkened living room with Lupin resting on her gloved hand.
Days pass, and we move through the intricate process of training. Next, I want her to jump to my fist for food. You cannot menace or punish a hawk. You must wait for them to choose to come to you.
The tentative hawk pauses, then uses her beak to snag a slither of meat from Helen's gloved fist. Lupin flaps her wings while she devours the food.
The space between the fear and the food is a vast, vast gulf, and you have to cross it together.
In slow motion, Lupin raises her legs and makes the short hop onto Helen's fist. With her wings raised, the hawk lowers her head and gorges on the meat.
She did it. You know, there was no half-heartedness about that. She was incredible. I'm really pleased with her. I'm really delighted with how that went. Couldn't have asked for better.
In her diary, Helen writes, jumped to fist.
Come on in, Lupin. Let's see what you weigh today.
Birds in falconry have a flying weight. I guess it's a bit like boxers have a fighting weight. Basically, if a hawk's full of food, is fed up, it's not going to want to fly at all, let alone fly towards you for food. So you have to monitor the bird's weight very, very carefully, and you do that by weighing the bird every day, sometimes twice a day.
She's doing so well.
She is, isn't she? It's phenomenal.
In slow motion, Helen's strolling past the cottage with Lupin on her hand.
The bird's been amazing, but it's kind of been hard too. I had a sleepless night last night. I woke up in the morning very early and had a bit of a week, which I didn't expect, and feel a bit like a truck's hit me. And I guess it's that combination of, you know, the raw stress and responsibility that it takes to look after a new bird like this and make sure you're doing everything right and not messing it up. Also, I haven't sat with a untrained goshawk on my hand since the year my father died, and it's kind of brought it all back. You know, I dreamt about him last night. Joked about Mabel, the hawk I had back then. A bit of weird time travel going on, and it's kind of hard. I'm having to process some stuff again.
A dramatic image of a jet plane silhouetted against a full moon.
Dad was, I think, the first person to take a photograph like this one. He'd been a plane spotter as a boy, cycling from his home to local aerodromes where he'd stand for hours staring at the sky. We were both, in a sense, obsessed with the same thing. Creatures that lift off and take your heart with them when they fly.
A silhouette of a twitching hawk's head against the bright moonlight.
After Dad's death, my grief-spurred dreams were filled with wings. But now, I was dreaming of Mabel. I dreamed of the hawk that had been my refuge. There was no regret or mourning in her, no past nor future. She lived in the present moment only, and that was my escape. Watching her hunt felt like gambling, though the stakes were bloodier. You put all your skill, your very soul, into training the hawk, then step back and relinquish control. That's the gambler's hook. Once the dice roll, once the hawk leaves the fist, you open yourself to fate, and you cannot control the outcome.
Lupin swoops low over a field, then lands in thicket beside a dead animal.
I had hunted with hawks for years before I lost my father. I never considered it cruel. Wild hawks hunted. So did mine. It's what hawks do. It's what they're made of. Training a goshawk and not letting it hunt still seems to me like raising a child and not letting it play.
In the middle of the living room, Lupin sitting on a bow perch. Helen's cleaning her Jess beside a collection of dozens of tasseled falconry hoods.
What's really got to me is that you can still see on the leather here these little tiny nicks and cuts that were made by Mabel's talons. It's really strange how history kind of inheres in material objects. It's a kind of a bit of a dizzying sense, really, that She's still here. She's still here in the mucks on this glove.
Flames erupt from a metal drum outside the cottage.
Mabel was the fire I used to burn my hurts away. She was my way of escaping human contact. Training Lupin with Kirsty is different. I'm accepting help. We're doing it together.
When I trained Mabel, I'd really bought into that idea that falconry was all about solitude, a sort of monkish seclusion, just you and your bird. And you know what? I mean, the early days, you do need to do that, but, I've been sitting with Kirsty and her goshawk, and we've been manning them, taming them together, and chatting about everything. You know, I've just realised that that's how falconry is, and it has been, you know, for centuries all over the world. You know, people train hawks together. It doesn't have to be this dark kind of pursuit that it was after my father died. It can be something much more full of joy, much more full of company. And that's a nice thought.
Holding a mug, Helen's leaning against the wall of the cottage while the sun beams down. A line in her diary reads, "Jumped to fist."
Time runs forward, and Lupin scarcely misses a step of our intricate training dance.
She writes, "Outside jumping."
Lupin is currently 2 pounds, 10 ounces. You know, she's responding really well to that weight. She's very, very attentive. She's feeding on the fist. She's, you know, completely in the right zone.
She cuts some string from a reel.
Before a hawk flies free, a falconry bell the size and shape of an acorn is fixed onto its topmost pair of tail feathers next to a tiny radio transmitter mount. These help us find the hawk if it flies out of sight.
I know you're a bit noisy now, but...
First, though, I fly Lupin on a long line of braided cotton called a creance. It is both a literal line of attachment and something more than material reassurance.
Helen whistles, then holds out her arm. In slow motion, Lupin takes flight, leaving her perch on the ground and darting towards Helen's fist. The hawk returns to its stand, then Helen runs further away. Lupin takes off again and lands on Helen's outstretched fist.
That went brilliantly. She's in a ferociously good mood right now. And so am I. I mean, I sort of think she's ready to fly free. There was no real hesitation there. She didn't try and veer off. She just, in fact, at one point she was so desperate to come, she didn't let me walk away. So, she completely trusts me. She wants to come to me for food. She's thinking about flying away. I think we're there.
As the sun peaks from behind dark clouds, Helen finds a grassy mound which has a commanding view of a verdant valley.
I'll be really happy to see this bird fly free. I mean, it's the summation of it all, isn't it? All those bonds and lines of trust that you've created over the weeks suddenly are tested. Yeah, you sort of have a sort of sleepless night before you fly a bird free for the first time, every single time this happens. Let's hope it works.
Now everything is accelerating towards that crucial point. Point in the sense of time. Point in the sense of aim. Point in the sense of something so sharp it hurts. Letting the hawk fly free.
The shadow of Helen preening Lupin's feathers is cast on a wall. A montage of flashbacks to Lupin's progress in learning to fly free. In time-lapse, clouds pass across the sky. Now Helen looks out of a window at mist cloaking the horizon.
Well, this is typical. The day that I planned to fly Lupin free, the whole valley is buried in fog. The problem is that if she veered away from the fist and disappeared into a tree and or kept going, we wouldn't be able to find each other. You know, it's even though she's wearing a transmitter, it's going to be very hard to sort of catch up with her, and I'm not going to risk that. So I'm just praying that the fog will lift.
Lupin standing proudly on a perch.
Fog's a strange thing. Everything just goes into stasis. It's kind of what certain stages of grief feel like. Everything familiar becomes obscured and sort of buried. Nothing seems to be moving. You don't really recognize where you are. Familiar landscapes seem really strange, and you just have to wait it out until you don't feel like that anymore.
From delicate lace-like cobwebs to a spoonful of coffee and a steaming kettle. In speeded-up footage, the sun breaks through the mist.
Slowly, the fog seeps away.
Okay, let's do it. Stop.
And we decide to call Lupin to the fist once on the creance before flying her free.
Helen holds a piece of raw meat in her gloved fist, while Kirsty stands further down the field with Lupin. In slow motion, the hawk pushes off Kirsty's hand. It lands on Helen's fist, but Helen scrunches up her face, then shakes her head dismissively. To Kirsty.
Yeah, she's not ready to go free. Didn't quite work. She's not quite ready. She's at the right flying weight. She should really, as soon as the hood's off, she should be flying towards me. It should be an instant response. And she just sort of sat there and had a look around, like, you know, And Kirsty and I both decided it wasn't going to happen today. So tomorrow. Tomorrow is the day. Sorry about that, Loops. But all's fair in love, war, and falconry.
In the diary, Helen writes day 43. On a volume control, she turns the dial to 4, then slides the transmitter onto Lupin's feathers.
It's always scary. You're always frightened it's not going to work and she might fly away, but I feel pretty good about it today. I think she's the right weight. She's obviously quite eager to fly. So all being well, we should get the hawk back at the end of the day, and that's what you want. You know, falconry is in many ways deep down about conjuring presence and absence. It's about having this wild creature that has decided that it wants to come back to you.
I think it might be all right. Should we do it?
Blood pressure goes up, heart rate goes up. This is the moment.
She detaches the tether and Lupin drops onto the perch, which is embedded into the ground. Helen scampers across the field, then raises her arm. The hawk soars through the air, then extends its legs at the right moment to land cleanly on Helen's fist.
We have liftoff. Big surge of adrenaline here. Well done, you.
Helen drops Lupin back onto the perch, then scurries through the field. Lupin takes flight and touches down on her fist. Helen breathes a sigh of relief.
That just happened. She flew free for the first time. I'm super, super proud of her. Yeah, really, really happy.
In time-lapse, clouds move across the sky above the cottage. In slow motion, Lupin drops onto the perch and Helen extends her gloved hand.
We've reached that wonderful point where Lupin is what's called in falconry a maid hawk. She's flying free. And now what we have to do is transform her life from that of basically just flying backwards and forwards to my gloved hand into something much more like that of a wild hawk. So teaching her about wind and flying into trees and learning about quarry and the whole kind of wider landscape.
From leaves on a branch flapping in a breeze to a Gothic chapel.
Cambridge. I've spent years of my life here, sitting in libraries and seminar rooms.
River punting.
First as a university student, and then as a college research fellow. It's a place I love very much. But what's most special about it isn't deep in its ancient bricks and mortar. It isn't even in the city itself.
Thick foliage.
It's here, in the surrounding woods and fields.
This is one of the places where I used to bring Mabel. She sat in pretty much all of these trees. It's like a place full of ghosts. Not bad ghosts. I remember the dotted lines and the curves of all the different flights we had here. This was a landscape that for me was one that was marked with extreme beauty, but also a lot of darkness. A lot of the time I was here, I was in this other place, this other world of not really knowing who or what I was. It's intense. And of course, as I sit here, lost in my human memories, you know, Lupin's just thinking, is there anything here I can catch? Are there any rabbits? What's going on? And I think that this disconnect is really important. You know, we give all our meanings to animals. We make them into our own image. And here I am thinking about the bonds I had with Mabel, the bonds I've had with goshawks, you know, this incredibly ancient human-hawk relationship. And yet this thing's thinking, this human is just a hunting perch and, you know, what can I chase? I know.
Bobbing her head from side to side, Lupin raises her broad tapered wings. Now in slow motion, Helen's rambling through a wheat field holding the hawk.
It's been a really fascinating and amazing few months. I guess a lot of things have changed. What wild goshawks mean to me has subtly changed. And what trained ones mean, it's really interesting. You know, I never thought I'd get another bird after Mabel. Mabel was the goshawk of my life. And of course, what I've forgotten is Mabel was the goshawk of the life I had then. She was the bird who belonged to a different person. And now I've got Lupin, and she's a very different character from Mabel. And I love her to bits. It's really great to share life with her.
Helen looks at Lupin proudly, then strokes the hawk's claw.
My life is not as completely empty as it was back in those dark days after Dad died. I have a lot on, but I'm going to fly Lupin as much as I can over the season. The idea that my life is going to be punctuated with flickering beauty for goshawk's wings is just makes me... It's going to sound really, really cheesy, but it makes me feel like a whole person again.
Helen beams as Lupin takes flight.
Goshawks are always going to be part of who I am, and I'm really glad about that.
Helen burrows her face into Lupin's feathers and closes her eyes. As she moves away, a smile is etched on her face as she gazes at the hawk adoringly.